This is Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell, and I am glad you're with us. But you know what? Sitting back, I got to admit that when I start thinking about the program, I'm continually faced with, how do I help people understand that we're in the midst of historic financial and social change? It's a monetary crisis. We're watching our currency collapse in terms of buying power of essentials like food, energy, housing, and people don't seem to care. I mean, back in February last year, I wrote a piece that basically said when gas hits $2 a liter and predicted it would be this quarter of this year, I thought then it will finally get people's attention. You know what? I think I was wrong. There seems to be very little connection to the role that government decisions have made in gas prices, higher home prices or inflation. So you know what? This week, I'm bringing in some high-priced help. Best I can get. As I'm joined by Luke Grohman, founder, president of Forest for the Trees Research, to talk about why we should care about the historic financial changes that are taking place and what they're going to do with you. Because I'll tell you, if people aren't prepared, I think it's going to devastate them. But first, in light of their ban of Russian oil imports, we have U.S. asking Venezuela for oil. I mean, come on, if that's not an admission of monumental failed energy policy, first under Barack Obama and then Joe Biden, who both rejected Keystone XL pipeline while discouraging oil production in the U.S., well, I'm not sure what would be. Okay, begging Saudi Arabia and being willing to sign a compromise nuclear agreement with Iran's got to be up there too. But when I first read that the U.S. sent a delegation to Venezuela, who Amnesty International has condemned for relentless human rights abuses, stating that the government of Nicolas Maduro, in quotes, is attacking the most impoverished people that it claims to defend, but instead it murders, detrains, and threatens them, end of quote. But I couldn't believe it when I read that a delegation had gone down, willing to end some sanctions in return for oil. And by the way, it doesn't look like Venezuela's prepared to actually do that, because maybe their relationship with China is more important. But I'm still shaking my head. But a big no to Canadian oil through Keystone XL under both Presidents Obama and Biden. But now they put out the welcome wagon for human rights abusers, the all-stars like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. Come on, you got to be swallowing real hard for that one. But clearly, the oil shortage, my point, was inevitable. Come on, after all, for decades, the mainstream, along with the majority of people in the West, have given center stage to climate change activists who pushed an anti-fossil fuel agenda. Many of them, by the way, also anti-nuclear power. But there's no doubting their sincerity, but it's the passion. Come on. But the anti-fossil fuel mantra is presented without realistic or practical boundaries. That's what we've been talking about in Money Talks, and I got the hate mail to prove it. But obviously, that didn't bother university faculties who pushed divestment or politicians who relentless virtue signals about climate change or public school establishment who pressed a one-sided agenda onto students who, along with many in the media, seem not to appreciate even the basic facts, like realistic replacement for thousands of products, including pandemic hazmat suits and other medical equipment that are made from petroleum. What about them? And it's slowly being appreciated by people who are angry about paying those record high gasoline prices in Canada, Europe, US, that the climate change agenda has been a triumph of virtue signaling over critical thought. I can't say that often enough. Come on, despite decades of climate conferences, I think it was 26, the practical aspects of the energy transition, starting with even a realistic outline of the specifics, is missing. I mean, how big is that task? How many wind turbines, solar panels are needed to replace fossil fuel power? Even straightforward questions like how many charging stations will we need if we do have an EV revolution? Even a first mention of where you're going to produce or obtain the raw materials necessary hasn't been outlined, along with an estimated cost, how to pay for it. And what about the transition itself? We've been told by numerous climate activists that peak oil demand is imminent, so no need for more pipelines in Canada, when in fact, the International Energy Agency forecasts that demand for natural gas and oil is going to increase by 21 and 22% respectively, increase by 2040. You know, it isn't just the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions on Russian oil that created the current energy emergency. The impact was already obvious in Europe and the UK when they had the failure of wind and solar without adequate backup power through the fall, the commissioning of nuclear power without a substitute. They're already causing huge hardship, skyrocketing prices, energy shortfalls. It was all in the fall. China saw the same thing, massive price hikes, rolling blackouts. You got to think that reality is a harsh mistress. Incredibly, it seems like it's just dawning on some political leaders and a huge number of the public that energy is essential. I mean, the about face is astounding. I'll just give you a couple examples before I finish. I mean, we have from COP26, the mantra, no more fossil fuels. That was in November. And now we need more oil production. I mean, what an amazing 180 done by the U.S. Secretary of Energy. Her name's Jennifer Granholm. She told energy leaders just this week, in quotes, she was extending a hand of partnership to the oil and gas industry. Head shaking. I mean, it's the Biden administration, for goodness sakes. They're scrambling. They're desperate, as are leaders throughout Europe. Because, and this is the part they won't admit, their own failed, unrealistic policies, so simplistic in nature that they ignored the reality that discouraging and shutting down fossil fuel production needed an alternative energy grid, based on renewable energy, of course. Without that, though, is a guarantee of higher prices and more dependent on despotic regimes like Russia. And as usual, guess who's paying the highest price? Yeah, I sing this song all the time. I get it. Because it's not the leaders, though, or the climate activists or the delegates at COP26. This is a disaster for people who can least afford it, afford the higher fuel and food costs and overall inflation that are a direct result of government policies. As famed economist Thomas Sowell put it, it's hard to imagine a more stupid or more dangerous way of making decisions than by putting those decisions in the hand of people who pay no price for being wrong. Well, they were dead wrong, and we are paying a price. Hey, stay with me. I got so much planned. I got a shocking stat, but then I'm bringing on Luke Grohman. You can't miss this interview. Tell your friends, tell your family. Must listen stuff. Before I get to Luke Grohman, I'm going to do a shocking stat of the week because I think it provides important background for this interview. And I think also, I mean, one of the key things to your financial future is what interest rates are going to do. So let me just throw it out very quickly to you. U.S. federal debt's about $30 trillion. It's borrowed money. Okay, so what do you do when you own a bond that is paying you? Remember, when you own a bond, you've lent the government money. So you're, and it's paying you 2% a year. That's what a 5-year or a 10-year bond, same thing in the U.S. is. You lend money to the U.S. government for 10 years or 5 years, you get under 2%. But you know what? Inflation's much higher. In the U.S., it's 7.9%. Same problem in Canada. Low interest rates, high inflation rate. So I'll take the U.S. as that example. 7.9% inflation, you're only getting 2%? Well, you're losing 5.9% in buying power a year. So what are you going to do? You're going to just keep holding it for the 5 years, lose every year? Or you're going to try and get out of it? You're going to sell it. But when you sell it, who's on the other side to buy? Well, I can't see anybody in their right mind wants to buy that and hold for 5 years. So you sell it. That forces interest rates up. That's the big danger, and it can happen overnight. Here's a quick question. How high would interest rates have to go before you would lend money when you've got inflation at 7, 8, 9%? That's what we're really talking about. Well, the government can't afford that with $30 trillion in debt. Our government can't afford it with our debt load. We can't afford any kind of higher spike. But that's what'll happen if en masse, people who already have lent money through holding bonds go, you know what? What a terrible deal this is. That'll force more central bank buying, more inflation. I'll get to this with Luke Grohman, so stay with me. I've been looking forward to a chance to getting a chance to talk with Luke Grohman. He's the president founder of Forest for the Trees, and I'll tell you how to get a hold of that in just a second and follow him on YouTube. He does a great sort of 5 to 10 minute weekly YouTube broadcast that I find is essential listening. Why? Because he has a very broad understanding, and that's not quite the right words I'm looking for. It's an incredible understanding, but of the bigger pictures first. Make your decisions after you understand what's going on a macro level. Luke Roman does that. He joins me now. Luke, thanks for finding time for us. I can tell you all of Canada has got a smile on their face. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm going to throw something at you that I said at the top of the show I'm struggling with. And that I think some of the things that are going on are so monumental, and maybe we've sensed it, by the way, with record gasoline prices. People might know, hey, there's something going on here. Or we're going to talk later about that incredible situation on the London Metals Exchange with nickel that went up to over $1,000, and then they canceled it, that kind of thing. Everywhere we look, it's been one of the themes of Money Talks. It's just open your imagination. Don't tell me what can't happen, because it's about to. And I'm sort of sitting there going, I have trouble getting people to understand this is fundamental. This is changing their financial lives. And some people are going to be roadkill. So I'm going to start by throwing that question to you. How do you get people to pay attention and care about this? Why should they care?
Why should they care? I think you're right. I think there is absolutely a monumental shift happening in the global financial system. And in the global economy, and maybe a better way of putting it is a global marking to market of shifts that have long been underway. And so if you look to, say, for example, China and emerging markets more broadly, in 2013, emerging markets became the majority of global GDP for the first time in almost 300 years. And there was a small article in the Financial Times on the eighth page, and people sort of moved on. And there have been other hints like that. China became the world's biggest oil importer, surpassing the United States a few years back. Small article, people moved on. U.S. debt to GDP surpassed 100% for the first time since the immediate aftermath of World War II. There's been some notice there, more articles, but there's been so much concern about U.S. debt levels for so long that it's almost been a case of the boy who cried wolf. And so there's not been that much concern. There was a period of time in 2005 where there was to 2010, there were concerns about peak oil or peak cheap oil. And U.S. shale came in and helped ameliorate that issue. And now you have some articles in the last year or two that U.S. shale is peaking and that it can't probably produce a lot more than it is. And so I think the reason why there's been the complacency we've seen is there are so many things that are coming together all at once from different angles. And they're each problematic, but not necessarily catastrophic. And it's only when you start layering these things on one after the other where they become catastrophic. So, for example, something we've been talking a lot about is, or potentially catastrophic. So, for example, one of the things we've been talking about is yes, peak cheap energy, where it's not that we're running out of energy, but that energy is increasingly becoming more and more expensive to find sufficient quantities of it. That in and of itself would not be a problem in an equity-based society, in a society that was not massively over-levered. However, energy is ultimately nature's real discount rate. It's the true discount rate of economic activity. And basically every financial asset on the board, including sovereign debt, is effectively priced off of, on the assumption of a continuously growing supply of cheap and affordable energy. And so if the marginal supply of energy gets more and more expensive, the marginal financial asset becomes less and less sustainable. And the problem is once you get debt levels as high as we have, we really can't afford, in the West in particular, but China in certain ways as well, elsewhere around the world, we have levered this system to such an extent by virtue of the serial bailouts for the last 30 years that we can't afford to have even the marginal piece of debt become diseconomic, uneconomic, start to default, because it will touch off. It's like smoking in a nitroglycerin plant. What's the right number of cigarettes to have in a nitroglycerin plant? And the answer is a zero, because if one catches the wrong way, the whole thing, it's, you're not going to be able to stop that chain reaction. And so I think that's why it's so important to it, why it's a hard to see, but that once you start seeing it and the way these, the interplay of these different factors have a potential of interacting with each other, it's very difficult to unsee it.
And your point about all of these things coming together, at least I feel it, actually. I actually feel it. I've been saying, I haven't felt this busy where I feel 24 hours a day, I have to be watching different markets and different things. There's so much coming at us and it's all, you know, so much significance. But let's come back to the debt issue there. I mean, to me, that's an overriding context for policy limitations. And one of the things that I think people are more familiar with is the inflation story, i.e. things are more expensive. And the normal response to that is we'll raise interest rates. We've had the Bank of Canada, we've had Europe, we've had Japan, and of course the Federal Reserve saying, yeah, we're going to raise interest rates, but we're going to do a lot of it coming up. I see that's out of the question now. I mean, you've got a slowing economy, you know, thanks to record energy prices. And what, you're going to raise rates into that and make it worse for government who's overextended? I mean, as I say, so many factors. I just don't see that happening.
And that's the thing I think that is, it's not different this time, but it's very different than anything else people have seen in their lifetimes. And what I mean by that is we have not seen a global sovereign debt bubble since, particularly in the developed markets, since the immediate aftermath of World War I. And so there, we went through this process over the last 20 years. In the U.S., we had an equity bubble. It popped. We kicked it upstairs to the housing sector, to the banking sector via a housing bubble. It popped. We kicked that problem upstairs to the sovereign level via government backstops of basically everything. And so now governments are so overlevered, the symptom of a problem there is inflation. To your point, you've got to tighten rates, but you can't because you would need to cut U.S. governments, or you cut government spending. And I'm most familiar with the U.S., but when you look at U.S. government spending, U.S. government's 20 to 25% of GDP. So if you cut government spending, you're going to cut GDP, which is going to make the problem worse, not better. If you don't cut rates, inflation's going to get, or raise rates, excuse me, you're going to get inflation worse. And so it has been lost, I think, in the West, because everybody that lived through it after World War I and traded through it obviously is dead. And so the collective consciousness of this is lost. Now, if we went down to Latin America and we described what is happening here, we remember that. You're just describing 1982 through 2002. That was that period of time for us, this rolling series of crises, financial crises, sovereign debt crises, currency crises, high inflation, inability to raise rates enough, et cetera, et cetera. And regrettably, what we're seeing is, I think, in real time, the destruction of a false narrative. So in 2005 in the United States, the narrative was U.S. home prices could never fall nationally. They had never fallen nationally. That was false on both metrics. After the fact, we, of course, learned they could. But U.S. home prices had fallen nationally in the Great Depression. And so there was just what they were really saying is, oh, we couldn't have a crisis big enough to have that happen again. And of course, that was proven false. In the same way, there is this false narrative in the United States and in the West more broadly that sovereign debt doesn't matter. And everybody believes it because it hasn't mattered in such a long time. But here we are. And so what it ultimately comes down to is are the sovereigns going to have the discipline to take the pain, slash the spending, raise the rates, and crash their economies and go through the austerity and pain that implies? And quite frankly, that would imply restructuring or defaulting on entitlements and sovereign debt in the West, along with slashing defense spending, which I find highly unlikely for political and economic reasons, or printing the difference, the central banks printing the difference into an inflation. And that really takes you to our two potential paths at this point, which is severe austerity, economic pain, restructuring of basically the entire social contract in social democracies in the West. In other words, for example, in the United States, dear 70 million baby boomers, I know you're used to getting a Social Security check every month. Now it's only going to come every other month. And foreign holders of treasuries, we're only going to send you two coupons a year on your interest payments, not four. That is one option. I think the odds of that happening are extraordinarily slim. I think much more likely is that the Fed is going to come out and under the auspices of we need to make sure the Treasury market functions properly or the smooth functioning of credit markets, we are going to actually increase liquidity. I don't think they're going to call it QE because I think they want to try to preserve the last shreds of credibility that is tattering for them. But say, listen, we're going to special Treasury functioning facility. And the gist of it is they're going to do more QE into this inflation spike. And inflation's going to keep getting worse. And I think it will. We'll go through a period of 5 years where we see extremely high inflation. It'll be underreported to some extent. And at the end of that period of time, the real, the debt to GDP will be worked down to a level from which these countries can actually raise rates without blowing things up. And it's a time-honored way of doing things. And what it just speaks to is you know, what's normal for the spider is chaos for the fly. And so for bondholders are the flies here. They're going to get eaten by the spider, which is inflation. And so it just is, particularly for people in retirement on fixed incomes, I think you're already starting to see it's becoming critical to have assets that can offset the inflation. I don't think this is temporary. I think they're going to tell you it's temporary the whole time. That's what they do throughout history. So I think it's important to understand the underlying factors driving this quote unquote temporary inflation, because once we do, we see it's probably not temporary. I mean, everything's temporary, right? In the long enough timeline, I think it's going to last several years.
Well, and again, we look at the energy market situation, which was already showing itself with problems in, you know, in the fall in Europe and in China, you know, and of course it's been exacerbated by the sanctions on Russia or the threatened sanctions, et cetera. But to me, that just means, you know, inflation's with us. I mean, energy is every transporter to every good, let alone the food prices because of fertilizer and all of this kind of stuff. So then it begs the question, okay, I mean, as you said, there are so many things coming at us, and sort of you get caught between, I'm oversimplifying, but I want to make sure people have some takeaways here too. And that is what you're describing to me is a very negative for paper currency. And as you've described on Forest for the Trees, people don't get it. We've had a crash in terms of oil. You know, our buying power has crashed. Forget versus the euro. It's crashed versus copper. It's crashed versus nickel. You know, all of those things. That to me is another massive story. Part of how do I protect myself? Because, gosh, if I'm saving at a 2% rate, and I'll just give you an example up in Canada, we had housing prices go up 20%, similar in most urban areas in the States. Well, you know, I hardly want to be saving then, you know, or using that savings vehicle. So let's talk just very quickly on the scenario that inflation that you were just referring to. How do we protect ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's important to reframe the discussion away from the dollar is strong because it's rising against the euro and the yen effectively when you look at something like the DXY index. And instead reframe it as the dollar is falling against things I need to live, shelter, food, housing, energy, education at a very rapid clip. And so I think it ultimately is about understanding A, that this is happening, and then B, understanding that this is not like the last 40 years where, well, the government is going to come in and save me from losing a lot of my purchasing power because they're going to raise rates to contain inflation. The government's balance sheet is in a position they cannot do so. The government is not going to cut themselves off by raising rates. This is an emerging market type playbook. They are going to print the money so that the government can keep spending, purchasing power be damned. And so it becomes really critical to own assets that over time will hedge that depreciation of the currency against things you own. And so those types of things are commodities, industrial related assets, certain finite residential real estate, certain other finite commodity related properties, farmland, things like that, gold, I think Bitcoin, certain types of tech equities like the Microsofts and the Googles of the world. I mean, basically, if you buy Microsoft, you buy Google. You're buying the American government. You're buying the people that are going to be printing the money for themselves. So I think that, you know, it's not like Google's going to get cut off for lack of money from the U.S. government. Their contract's going to keep getting paid. So those types of tech names where there's a good, strong free cash flow dynamic to the business. But these are the types of assets you're going to want to have an overweighting to, because I know a lot of the lives, particularly, again, for people on a fixed income, they tend to have these lifestyle or these life cycle models that are based on the last 40 years, which in all reality, the last 40 years are extraordinarily peaceful, non-volatile, non-inflationary. And right, so they're all a lot of some version of 60-40 equities, fixed income, adjusted for your age. And the older you get, the more fixed income you should have. And what we're describing here is we should be upgrading the risk of currency depreciation, upgrading the inflation risk on the fixed income side of the portfolio, and really try to think more in terms of real purchasing power. And so what that means in practical terms is just whatever percentage you have in these inflation hedge type assets per the life cycle model, you probably should be a bit heavier than that and a bit lower than that than what the life cycle model says for fixed income, because it just you're not getting paid to hedge those inflation risks.
It seems a rock and a hard place again when you look at, okay, I own a bond, and if the government's going to manipulate or continue to manipulate interest rates down, or, you know, I know they ended the quantitative easing in the States this past week. Canada was about, off the top of my head, 5 months earlier. That's what kept interest rates down. So they're stepping away, but I'm going to see them forced to step back in, because who the heck wants to buy looking at like a 10-year at under 2%, you know, when I know inflation. I don't have to have the government tell me what inflation is. I went to the grocery store. I went to the gas pump. As you say, I watched my rent, or I watched the purchasing power on in terms of a hard asset like a home. You know, to me, I don't even know who's owning these things now, because it makes so little sense. And so it's going to be forcing the Federal Reserve and Central Bank of Canada and others to step back in and be the main owner. I mean, this is why I say it's a fundamental shift in the economy or the financial system.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think ultimately that's going to be, to me, the big aha moment or oh crap moment coming for a lot of investors in the West in particular, in these developed markets, is the realization that, yes, absolutely, central banks can print money into an inflation spike. And they will, because of the sovereign, and really it's just sovereign debt actually matters. It doesn't matter for long, long stretches. And then it's all that matters. And we're in that part of the economic cycle that happens with roughly once every 80 to 100 years, where all that matters is the sovereign debt. And so in order to keep the sovereign debt nominally solvent, they're going to have to keep printing money to keep interest rates artificially low, keep real interest rates significantly negative. And significantly negative real interest rates is a really good environment for commodities, gold, real estate, hard assets, not, and a really bad environment for bonds.
And again, I don't want to talk sort of my own theme here, but we've been calling it a monetary crisis, saying it started, you know, late last year in, and it's part of what I referred to as our money doesn't buy much. Yeah, I can buy Japanese yen, but I can't eat it. But I need food, I need energy, I need housing. And I'm seeing this, and the scenario you're describing, I see just the dismantling of purchasing power. And so I'm just trying to, again, implore people, pay attention to what Luke's saying. You've got to make a shift, because you're going to wake up. And one of the things I've noticed in the market, Luke, is once something starts moving, once it becomes on the radar, it's so abrupt, it's so fast. It's not some sort of incremental shift here. And I see that, by the way, with, you know, we've seen, you know, Bitcoin isn't quite there in terms of, you know, finding the equilibrium on a daily basis, you know, but, you know, and gold's looking for that. But when you measure it against every other commodity, I'm just back to, please pay attention.
I think that's right. It does. You've seen these, they little by little and then all at once. And I think that we're seeing that all at once in various situations, and unfortunately, I think we're going to see it more frequently in a number of different markets in coming weeks, months, and quarters.
Let me shift gears just for a second. and come to a couple of actions that we've seen from government. I'm talking, it started literally, I think it started in Canada when the federal government decided to freeze assets of people or bank accounts of people who donated to a legal protest. And now we find out that it was exactly as the protest presented and not what the government, it was not foreign funded. It was 88% Canadian funded with small amounts. So clearly it was populist in that notion. But for me, it was, oh my gosh, 15 minutes later, we froze the assets of Russian oligarchs. We froze, I mean, this is what will shock people. We froze central bank assets of Russia. I think that is also profound if I'm talking, and I know this is getting into sort of deep water, but the dominance of the US dollar, when we politicize these kinds of things, again, big stuff is happening out there.
I agree. I think ultimately what we just saw, I think in particular that freezing of the central bank's FX reserves, I think we will look back in time, whether that's a year, 2 years, 5 years, I think we're going to look back in time with and see that as every bit as important as when President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. I wrote this week that what the United States did by freezing Russian central bank FX reserves was that the United States closed the FX reserves window. And so they are going to, I think you've got $12 trillion in global FX reserves. People say, well, Russia's a bad actor. It's only for bad actors. Well, if you go back over the last 80 years, the list of countries that the United States has never considered a bad actor at some point in time is exceedingly short. Japan was a bad actor in the 80s. France was a bad actor in the 60s and 70s. Britain was a bad actor in the 50s. And those are our best friends. The Germans were bad actors at Pines in the 60s, 70s. We're talking post-war era. We're not even getting into the last 100 years where obviously there were more adversarial relationships. So the point here is that I think what we just did completely changed the mindset at the supranational sovereign bank level regarding the stockpiling of FX reserves, and this has as rainy day assets. And so I think you're going to see $12 trillion in FX reserves bid for physical gold over time. And there's only $12 trillion of physical gold that was ever mined. So it's pretty bullish for gold, I think.
You've got to exactly what you anticipated my next question, because I'm saying, you know, one of the things I've noticed when we say we're going to put this sanction on, we're going to exclude them from the SWIFT system. Fair enough. I'm not debating that. I'm just saying what I have a problem with is no one seems to be looking at what will be the consequences of that. What, I mean, you think Russia is not going to do something? You think China is not going to do something? Observing exactly what you've outlined, when you become a political enemy, you're in play. Your money's in play. And so it is interesting. I saw that as a driver of gold prices. I mean, or where else are they putting their money? You know, if you're Russia, maybe you put it somewhat reserves in China. You know, I don't know. You know, I watch their bonds outperform U.S. bonds. So maybe that's the case. But something's going to transpire. That's why I thought, Ella, what you said, it was a monumental move. They are going to respond. And maybe digital currencies like Bitcoin become a beneficiary if government would leave them alone. And maybe they won't. Or gold or what have you. But it's monumental, I think.
I agree. And there's this blowback that we can never quite prepare for, right? So a perfect example of this is if you go back to 1993, there's articles from the UK media. I think it's the UK Independent. I mean, it's a fairly large paper there. And there's an article by a reporter named Robert Fisk, who I think ended up winning the Pulitzer, not for this article, but for his other work, at least was nominated. At any rate, the title of the article is "Anti-Soviet Warrior Puts His Army on the Path to Peace." And the picture in the article of the man was someone Americans would come to know very, very well a few years later. It was Osama bin Laden. So in 1993, we have this anti-Soviet warrior that was this noble, heroic Mujahideen fighting the Soviets, and he had won, and hurrah, we had you know, sent them Stinger missiles and these heroic Mujahideen. And 8 years later, look what happened. And so there's it's this boomerang effect, this blowback effect, sometimes on a pretty pronounced lag, but they have a way of getting, of magnifying by the time they blow back at you. And so for me, I think the Trudeau situation is exactly that. I think and this seizure of central bank reserves of foreign private assets. And let's simplify it. What's the value of Apple stock if the Chinese say we're seizing the Apple factories in China? What's the value of Cupertino residential real estate, Cupertino, California residential real estate, if the Chinese seize the Apple factories and the and Apple stock crashes? There's got to be a lot of Cupertino residential real estate that's effectively collateralized by Apple options, Apple incentive stock that would become worth a lot less. And you can just see how exquisitely and finely linked all of this is. And you can't just pull out these, you can't start doing these things without blowback. Now, I'm not saying I think Apple stock is short. I'm not thinking the Chinese will do this. What I do think is there's virtually no thinking on these types of second and third tier levels being done by the policymakers as they implement these smash and grabs or these weaponizations of finance. When you live in the biggest glass house of them all, it's ill-advised to start throwing stones.
That's a wonderful, bringing people to their attention, how intertwined it is. And I mean, it's not like we don't have precedent. Look what the Russian government or the Russian leading party this past week got passed that resolution that they could confiscate the assets of any American company that had left. Or now they've said you can't exchange rubles for foreign currency within the country. I mean, it's one of those governments can do anything statements, let alone freezing the bank accounts. That should have been enough evidence for everyone. But I'm looking at the Chinese tech stocks taking a dive finally, a significant dive, so I think the most since October 2008. And I'm going, okay, they're sort of worried about the stuff Luke just described, and rightly so. And it shows how intertwined. Now, I know I've kept you longer than we said, but it's fascinating and why I think people should go to Forest for the Trees, why you should go to YouTube. And I say, just type in Luke's name, Luke Groman. It's Forest for the Trees. I'm going to give the website address, FFTT-LLC.com. I'll put it up on all our social media. We'll send it out there so you don't have to memorize that, but you should do it. Luke, let's finish with sort of summing up here. And again, everyone's got their own financial circumstances and attitude and emotions. I get that. But I'm just sort of saying, I don't want to own bonds. Let me start with that. I don't want to get paid 2%. And I was early on that, made that very clear to our audience, boy, back in February of 2020, saying one more kick at the can in the bond market, then I'm out of there. Risk reward doesn't work. I want to make sure that I have a position, and this is me saying, and I want you to contradict me. I'm saying from in gold, Bitcoin is in play, other assets that will protect me from this blatant decline in purchasing power with inflation going to be with us. And, as I say, my goal is to protect people. I love your point. I hadn't considered it about Microsoft. It's going to be fueled by the U.S. federal government as an example. So that's pretty much safe. So, and an inflationary environment with us for who knows when.
I think that's right. I think it's important for people with, I think we're going to be in this inflationary environment. And then I think it's important to start factoring in these regulatory risks we all now run. And so I think there are politically acceptable inflation hedges and there are politically unacceptable inflation hedges. And what I mean by that is I think two of the best inflation hedges will be gold and Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is going to continue to be extraordinarily volatile. And so I think it's important to understand that. With that said, myself personally, I would not put more into Bitcoin than one would be willing to have the government lock up in cold storage for a decade, right? So you don't want to have too much. Similarly, gold. Gold was illegal to own in the United States for 40 years, from 1933 to 74. And so, again, I don't think that that is not my base case. It's private property now, that versus being currency back then. And so it is different. With that said, these are politically unacceptable hedges. And so I think you want to be as big as you can comfortably be in those, but you don't want to be 50, 60, 80, 100% in these things, because there's a significant, now we see, non-zero chance that governments can come out and say it's illegal to own this stuff. And now it's not that I don't think they're going to come door to door looking for it, but you're not going to be able to take it to a bank. You're not going to be able to monetize a lot of it in anything but a black market. That's not a great situation to be in. The flip side is what I would call politically acceptable inflation hedges. residential real estate, particularly attractive pieces of property on that are finite, on lakes and great mountain views, you know, out west by you, things like that that make them unique, finite, good inflation hedges. Equities, like we talked about, particularly those of an industrial commodity bent, some of the tech bent. I think I would much rather own, when you think about bonds, I would much rather own Clorox, Procter & Gamble, some of these consumer durable type staples names that are going to have a coupon to them or a dividend to them. And again, are more finite than the treasury issuance, you know, than we're likely to see. And the stock itself can rise in price significantly, whereas from here, treasury bond prices, sovereign debt prices more broadly around the world are going to be very hard pressed to rise significantly, because rates can really only not, they can't get that negative. So I think it's really, and then lastly, I think it is important. I am personally running with a bigger than usual cash position. And I think it is important in these times to understand that there is a scenario where we do go through some period of austerity, or we do go through some period of supply chain breakdown. It's not like supply chains were functioning really well when we went into this whole last 2 weeks. And so I think it's, as a volatility hedge, austerity hedge, things go pear-shaped hedge, to I think have more cash. That's not to say physical cash in a safe, although you may want some of that too. I'm just talking about within your portfolio, having I'm running with a bigger than usual cash position, simply as a hedge of the volatility that I think we're likely going to continue to see. And then also just giving me that optionality. I think the end game is very sustained high inflation, a sustained very high inflation. But if there's deflation first, that gives me the optionality of saying, okay, great, I can do this, that, and the other, and then go from there. So that's how I would answer that.
Get a sense of why I respect Luke Grohman's research to the degree I do. I know, you know, I'm old. I've been around. You know, I've had the pleasure of talking to lots of people, and it is a pleasure to pick the brains of people who do nothing but think at a higher level about the things that are impacting all of us. And no environment is going to impact us more than I think the one we're in right now, as described by Luke. So again, I want to say, go to YouTube, just click on Luke Grohman, Forest for the Trees. He does five, it might be 10 minutes, whatever. He does some Q&A every week, gives you a sample of what they get at Forest for the Trees. And again, that website address is FFTT, Forest for the Trees, straightforward, -LLC.com, forestforthetrees.com. Luke, can't thank you enough. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put a big red letter to be continued. We've got to talk again soon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. It was great talking, Michael.
Well, I've got to admit that here we are some months later, and I'm still reeling from the statement, we don't think about monetary policy, because that's what this world is all about. And I want to grab Mike Levy and get him to come in here, because I asked him to keep a look on what's going on to the people in Russia. I mean, we're seeing a huge drop in the ruble. Obviously, the sanctions are preventing a huge amount of import coming in. And what's it done to their life? So, Mike, let's bring him in. Mike Levy's here with me. Mike, let's start with the ruble's performance versus the U.S. dollar.
Mike, it has just tanked. I can't give you the exact number. I think you've got that. But the fact is, it has just absolutely fallen out of bed. It's down 50% against the dollar. That's since Russia sent in troops on February 24th. But I think it's much worse than the headline number they're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, they've now prevented any kind of foreign exchange. You know, within the country, you can't exchange for foreign currency. So people are stuck with it, and it buys next to nothing. And that's what I wanted to sort of get your quick take on. When I say buy next to nothing, this is the real deal. This is the real deal with paper currencies when they get out of favor. And that's obviously a mild way of putting it. I mean, the cost of living goes through the roof.
Well, we look at inflation here, and we're taking a look in Canada and the U.S. anywhere between about 5 and 8% inflation. And then you take a look at Russia, and that's annualized, Mike. That's not, you know, inflation for 1 month. That's annualized inflation. Then you take a look in Russia, weekly inflation. And if you wanted to buy a car, 1 week, or February 26th to March 4th. So February 25th, you could buy a car. And on March 4th, the car would cost you 17% more. An imported car, 15% more. 1 week inflation. TVs, 15%. But this is stuff that all hits home. Groceries in 1 week went up 7.7%. Vitamins went up 6% in a week. Now, start thinking about other things like fuel and transportation and everything else. But the impact of, I'm talking weekly inflation, and we are going 5.9 or 6% in Canada, 7 or 8% in the U.S., that's annual inflation.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because obviously no government like in that position wants to admit to this. Like their stats are not going to reflect it. I was sort of mentioning what happened in Turkey when their inflation rate was 50% in February alone. So they just fired the guy, the head of statistics. You know, I mean, that's the pressure. And I would sure it's the same thing in Russia right now.
I would have to say so. It's like cut the tongue out of the messenger, and that's basically what they did. But I think something that's really very important, and that's going to slip by the headlines, is that Fitch Rating Service downgraded Russia's credit ratings to junk status and said a default on Russia's foreign debt obligations is imminent. That's a huge impact because if your credit goes to junk, just think of it personally. If you go to junk status on your ability to do anything in the credit markets, including using a credit card, well, apply that to a whole country and it's just devastating.
Well, I'll give you a quick example. The biggest pension fund in California stands to lose $300 million. That's just one pension fund, let alone so many others, like BlackRock is just getting killed, and there's a whole list of them. And we're talking in the billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in an individual company, you know, if they have a major portfolio like BlackRock. So, yeah, I think that's a key story that you've brought up, is that Fitch is just basically saying these bonds are worthless. And I mean, after all, other than somebody who buys distressed assets and maybe they think it's too soon now, who'd want them? I mean, the Russian government is not going to be paying interest to foreigners, that's for sure. I mean, look what happened in China too, Mike, when the Evergrande, property developer, the first thing they said is, we're not paying foreign bondholders, you know, for this. And of course, that spread further. But I'll tell you one that's kind of interesting, Mike, on your inflation number. Steve Hanke is considered sort of the global expert economist. Johns Hopkins, he puts their annual inflation rate, you were giving us the weekly, annual at 101%. Now, but if it continues the way you've just said, Mike, we're going above that.
Absolutely. And Mike, they're going into recession, and you talk about recession or depression, but we literally take a look at recession, and if we see we have two quarters of negative growth, I know that's an oxymoron, then we're in recession. The Institute of International Finance predicts Russia will see its economy shrink by 15% in 2022. We look at 2%. Well, they're looking at 15%. And if that forecast comes to fruition, Mike, it would be a collapse worse than the 2008-2009 Great Recession. And also Russia, again, the 1998 debt default crisis, both of those combined. Russia is in such trouble, but the problem is you just can't isolate Russia. It affects, as we can see right now, everything and everybody. How about gas at $2.15 a liter?
Or record prices for wheat, for corn. I mean, the list is just a long one. And I also say that, I mean, this has got to be another one of those to be continued. But before we do, Mike, before I let you go, I want to come to gold for a second. You know, one of the premises on my Money Talks was to take a position in gold, take a position in silver. And my take was, because once it starts moving, it's too late. It just feels so fast. But I know you've been telling people for, decades, since you had hair, that that gold, you know, was exactly for this reason. It's a hedge. It's a protection.
It is, Mike, and that's why we have kept saying repeatedly, ad nauseum, that gold should be an integral part of your investment portfolio, a safe haven, and this is the reason why. What's going on now, if you have a position in gold. So I have a couple things to say very quickly. If you're thinking of initiating your first position now, maybe you should take a step back and think about that. If you have your position, like we've been drumming, playing that drum for so long, you could add to a position in here. That's that to me would make some sense on a pullback. But to initiate a position, I think maybe you've just got, I'm not saying don't do it, just take a second thought about doing it at these levels.
Yeah, well, it's a frightening time. I mean, it's, we can't compare to what's gone on in Russia, what happens to a paper currency when it comes out of favor. But of course, that's what the gold aficionados have been telling us for decades. Mike, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for the quote of the week. And I've got two for you today. The first I posted earlier in response to a question about what is Vladimir Putin's motivation for invading Ukraine? Well, obviously, I don't know. No one seems to know. But I think this quote must be considered as important context. In a State of the Union address in 2005, President Putin stated, "First and foremost, it is worth acknowledging that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. As for the Russian people, it became a genuine tragedy. Tens of millions of our fellow citizens and countrymen found themselves beyond the fringes of Russian territory," end of quote. Well, come on, he's describing Ukraine in that quote, that he wants to reunite with the Russians in eastern Ukraine for sure. Of course, he's gone further than that. But of course, the big worry is that he's going to go after other territories that were in the former Soviet Union. But I think he made it very clear, as I say, 2005, he thinks that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. And keep in mind, when things like the Berlin Wall fell, Vladimir Putin was a KGB agent working in the Berlin embassy. I mean, there's lots of stuff there, as I say, I'm only guessing, but that's got to be part of the context. The second quote is from well-known hedge fund manager Kyle Bass. He's the founder and chief investment officer of Hayman Capital, whose warning on the current situation proved to be extremely relevant and pertinent. In quotes, "Western sanctions are only as strong as their weakest link, and that is Germany. Between Germany's reliance on Russian gas and their business ties to the China's military, it's going to be very difficult to bring the Germans along on any coordinated effort to sanction Putin and Xi," end of quote. In this world where we see more and more aggressiveness on the part of various nations, obviously we're talking Russia, Ukraine, but there's other examples. One of the aspects of that, and we've been warned by the Canadian military, we've been warned by CSIS and everywhere else, I mean, just look around, is the advent of cyber attacks, you know, as part of the aggressive arsenal in geopolitical events going on. That's why I'm so pleased to have with me Ian Patterson. He's CEO of Plurilock Systems. Plurilock Systems, I mean, they are security experts. Ian, first of all, busy time for you. I know your company is active looking at your, you know, first Canadian acquisition, for example. The phone's ringing off the hook because, let's face it, cybersecurity is a big issue for individuals, for companies, and now blatantly for countries. So I appreciate you finding time. And let me just start with that Russia-Ukraine situation and the cyber hacks going on there.
Well, Mike, absolutely. It's great to be back. It's always good to chat. Unfortunately, I wish that it was under better circumstances. But listen, you're absolutely correct. Cyber war actually started prior to the troops rolling across the border. And in fact, about a week prior to the physical invasion of the Ukraine by Russia, I tweeted that the war had already started, because what we were seeing were cyber attacks. And these cyber attacks were hitting not only organizations and government agencies within Ukraine, but frankly, we were also seeing an uptick in cyber attacks elsewhere in the world. We had some critical infrastructure that was taken down in Germany. We saw that even in Canada, we saw that Global Affairs had suffered a cyber breach. This was in January. And so I think that the reality is that cyber is almost a precursor to when things get physical or when things get kinetic. And it's concerning. It's very concerning because it is impacting the everyday consumer. And so when we're talking about now conflict, we're talking about the blast radius that can occur, because it seems to be fair game that the nation states, excuse me, will be going after services affecting consumers.
And I think it's again, and it's understandable, not everyone has a technology expertise. you know, but we're talking about, you know, the cyber attack and the ability to take over, as you just said, infrastructure. It could ground every airline, you know. I mean, obviously it could do for military weapons too, or submarines. I mean, the list is just huge. And that's why I sort of emphasize the incredible importance. And this is a massive shift, that war doesn't just take place when soldiers face off, you know, as you said, and many others are talking about the concerns, as I said, including CSIS, including the Canadian military, where China's been more aggressive from the cyber attack point of view too, not just Russia. And, you know, this is where one of the battlefields is going to take place. Tell me, what can we do about that? When you look at that, is it just a case of constant research and development of higher tools to prevent it?
Well, I think one of the key trends that I'm seeing is that there are not enough qualified cyber workers to meet the demand. And so the question really is, what can we do about it? Well, one of the things we have to keep in mind is that there is massive negative unemployment when it comes to the cybersecurity field. So 2 years ago, the estimate was that there was 1 million cyber jobs unfilled. Last year, the estimate was that it was approximately 3 million cyber jobs left unfilled. So there's clearly a need for qualified people. There's not enough out there. And as we're seeing, there's a greater requirement that we have defenses based on all this conflict. Now, what can we do about that? Well, one of the things that we're doing at Plurilock is that we are extremely focused on using AI and machine learning to do more with less people. So anytime you have a problem, you can choose to solve that problem either by throwing more people at it or by throwing smarter systems at it. And we've opted to take the latter approach. And so that's why we're using a huge amount of artificial intelligence in our solutions. And more broadly speaking, I believe that the rest of the industry will be moving to more AI, more automated solutions, because frankly, we don't have a choice. You have to be able to do more. You have to be able to deal with more threats. And you have to be able to automate the cyber defenses, because there's simply not another option.
Let me talk investment for a second here, because as I've said in the past, you know, very clearly, and Jim Dines, I remember, was the first one who talked to us, gosh, it's years ago, saying, you wait, cybersecurity is going to be a monster industry. And he did that on this show for the first time. And of course, that's why we've, you know, I give him credit, because I've been following it since, and you've been a great friend of the show, sharing what's going on in the world. But one of the things I've noticed on the investment side is you got a lot of agreement on that. And I'm thinking the biggest you can get is, I looked at Alphabet and Google wrestling over taking over Mandiant. Can you kind of give us a little bit of background there? And I want to drill down to what you guys have done, because speaking of acquisitions.
Well, I think Mandiant is just a fantastic cybersecurity company. They've been a leader in the space, and it was actually rumored that there was a bidding war or some conversations between Microsoft and Google to try and see who was going to get at that asset. And it was announced just recently that they were acquired for a very high multiple. I think Mandiant is a trusted advisor to a lot of companies. And what Mandiant shows is that, you know, people are important, software is important. And that's really the same view that we have taken. And so part of the reason why Plurilock went public a year and a bit ago is because we believed that in order to solve our customer problems, we needed to be able to both build software and we also needed to acquire other assets that would ultimately help our customers achieve a zero trust solution. And so I'm very pleased to report on this show that we acquired our first Canadian company, a company called Integra, based in Ottawa. Just another great example of a profitable cybersecurity company with great customers, which is exactly who we're looking to acquire. And so an example, they sell to the Canadian government, they sell to RCMP, they sell to DND. And so this is really building on top of last year's acquisitions that we announced, including Aurora in California. And so we've established a strong foothold in California that also has extensive U.S. federal government contracts. Now we've backed that up with a strong Canadian presence right in Ottawa. We're going to continue to build innovative software. We're going to continue to look at other opportunities. And unfortunately, I think that the world needs these types of solutions. And I say unfortunately because you know, the more risk that is out there, usually the answer is you need more cyber defenses.
And again, yeah, absolutely. And we're looking at a field that's exploding. And again, it seems like we get another example. I remember when we used to talk going back quite a bit, and it would be an example that would certainly grab people's attention, like look at who got hacked kind of thing. Well, now I think people see it in a much broader sense. I mean, this is every aspect of our lives is, I'm going to use the layman's, you know, online kind of thing, you know, and it's under attack, though. That's the thing that I think is clear to people. It's a broad base. They're not just looking at, I'm trying to think of the dating website that was a famous hack a few years ago, Madison, I think, the name, I can't remember, but, you know, it's well beyond that now, you know, and that's what's interesting also. And I just, let me come back to this. You look at acquisitions, you look at their customer list, you know, like checkmark, look at the technology they've got, also the personnel. I mean, just give me your quick list of, say, three things, and I know it's more sophisticated, but three things that sort of create a checklist where you'll go further in looking at acquiring another company.
Well, for us at Plurilock, we operate two divisions. We operate a technology division where we build and sell very differentiated AI cybersecurity software. And then we also have a solutions division. And within the solutions division, we're looking at profitable cybersecurity companies that have great customers. Now, within that, we're looking within North America, we're looking specifically for customers who sell to the enterprise or to government agencies. We're not today focused on the small business, but you're absolutely correct. We're looking for long tenure. We're looking for profitable, disciplined operations, and we're looking for great customers. And we believe that there is an opportunity to acquire those businesses, to continue those operations. So we want to reinvest. We want to make sure those operations continue to grow. And we also want to be able to offer the products that we build in the technology division to those solutions division companies that we acquire. And that's how we believe that we are going to really increase shareholder value. So it's a little bit of a different strategy. I think most people are familiar with the traditional VC-backed cybersecurity company. The challenge with that model, I think, for the everyday consumer is that there's very little opportunity to get access to those investments. You have to be a venture capitalist, and they typically only go public once they're huge multi-billion dollar companies. Now, those companies are great, but I frequently get the feedback that the Plurilock is one of the very few public cybersecurity opportunities for the average investor to take part in.
I'll let you go shopping for the private equity sector for me. The expertise is obvious. Ian Patterson is the CEO of Plurilock Systems. By the way, the symbol is PLUR.V. PLUR.V. Ian, thanks for finding the time. We will visit again soon because the necessity is obvious.
Mike, thanks. It's always great to be here.
Let's get Ozzie Jurek in here, and I can't talk to Ozzie without first thanking him for his incredible support of the Special Olympics, and I can't thank enough people. You know, hundreds of people donated, and they wanted to see Ozzie in Lederhosen, me in Lederhosen, and I'll tell you, Ozzie, that water was cold. That's the real deal. I think it was 2 degrees with the wind chill down there, and thanks to Grant Longhurst, you know, here, he was the one who filmed it, and you can go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, and we'll put up some other pictures, as I say, over the week, but much appreciated people's support. But Ozzie, you look fabulous. You look absolutely fabulous. You are like a goodness gracious duck to cold water, where I was a shivering, whining wimp.
I was a shivering duck, though. But people really liked our dance, you know, the Laurel and Hardy routine we did. This was something to behold, you know.
And they can behold it by going to mikesmoneytalks.ca, and it's right there. But again, a big thank you. And that was the point, Ozzie. Without your help, we don't raise, I think it was over $44,000. Maybe we got to 45 by the time this airs. And people can still donate, obviously, because you can go to Polar Plunge 4. The number for specialolympics.com, plus it's on your website and social media, but all of the people who follow you, and of course you and our friends at Money Talks, much appreciated. That's all I can't say more than that because it is so sincere. But let's talk about real estate for a second. I feel like you and I should be sending a thank you note to the British Columbia government. because for years we have been talking about, despite the politicians telling us how much they care about affordable housing, we've said, then why are you adding so much to the cost of buying a house? Well, they delivered. They put it in their budget. And it's shocking how much just normal people pay for the privilege of purchasing a house. In British Columbia, it's called the property purchase tax, and it goes across the country in every place but Alberta and Saskatchewan. We're talking huge money added to the cost of buying a house.
Yeah, and it's crazy, and it's not easy because it's staggered. The rates are staggered depending on the price, and then different provinces have, like in Toronto, you actually get a base price for the city, and then you have another property transfer tax for the province. But in Ontario, essentially, it's 1% to 250,000, then 1.5% to 400,000, and from 400 to 2 million, it's 2%, and over that 2.5. In BC, it's 1% to 200 and 2% over. Okay, when you say that fast, it's only 1%, it's only 2%. But in BC, the average, or rather in the city of Vancouver, the average house price now is 2.2 million. Hard to believe. Any old shack anywhere between Mission and Lions Way is 2.2 million. Now, you add the various formula that is there, that $2.2 million house property transfer tax is $42,000. $42,000 to the province.
And again, for nothing but you bought a house. And that's what it kills me. I mean, there's many, many other examples of adding on to the cost. But I can just imagine someone who wants to get into that. And of course, you know, you mentioned Vancouver, but I mean, it's the same thing in Edmonton. Or sorry, excuse me, I meant to say Kelowna, which, you know, has not as high as Vancouver, but it's getting there. Victoria, not as high as, but getting there. You know, as I say, only Alberta and Saskatchewan don't have this tax. But there's so many others. And I'll ask you about another. If somebody actually builds a new home, because we know we have a supply problem, we got to do some building, but you're still paying GST and PST on the building materials.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling because the GST is 5%. So on that same $2.2 million house, it's $110,000 for GST. It's $42,000 for the property transfer tax. It's a whopping $150,000 plus just for buying the house, you know, and many people are actually surprised it couldn't possibly be this much. Yeah, but it is.
Well, and people would think, oh gosh, you know, developers did really well in making a new house, you know, and developing a new house, or homeowners. Hey, they didn't come close to the BC government in doing well, who didn't have to do anything, and they collected a record amount of property purchase tax.
Yeah, it's projected to be $3.5 billion, a record, right? Because we had huge house price increases and sales increases. So the province actually put it in their budget that there was $3.25 billion that they're projecting in total. And guess what? Not a nickel towards affordability.
Well, and think about this. Over the next 4 years or so, you're talking in the neighborhood of $1 trillion collected. And again, that's out of people who purchase a home. That's nothing to do with affordability, for goodness sakes. I mean, at least in Alberta, they can make the case that they don't pay PST on a new house, you know, when they build one, and they don't pay the property purchase tax, thank goodness. But I mean, look across the country. Everyone pays GST if it's a new build, and the list. And then municipalities, of course, have this huge array of levies, let alone once you get into the darn place, you're paying property taxes that keep going up. I mean, I'm just sort of trying to shine a light on the absolute BS, with a capital B, of the governments and politicians standing up saying, I care about affordable housing. The evidence is not in that direction.
Yeah, we should also point out, I always use Vancouver, which is a crazy example, but the average price in the province, throughout the province, again, all little communities, averaged, we have three other communities that are over a million, and the average price is around 950,000. So make it easy for me. Let's say it was a million, even in the smaller places, certainly in Kelowna, it's quite a bit more. You're looking at just under $20,000 tax for that. You know, it's not just the big properties, it hurts everybody.
Well, to stir the pot, it reminds me very much of gasoline. You know, when people say, look at the rising price of gas, absolutely, it's up probably 25% because of the Ukraine invasion. But then people have to look further, and they have to look again. I don't want to talk about Vancouver, but you got to when it's paying the highest gasoline taxes in North America to boot. You know, and again, thanks to the city of Vancouver, with an 18.5% sort of transit levy, or I don't know, there's so many different names and there's so many different taxes. But it's, again, it's interesting how politicians feign concern. Oh, the rising gas prices. Well, you'd go, well, for goodness sakes, don't add on a new carbon tax increase April 1st. Oh, well, that's different, again, other than Alberta. But other places are going to have one, British Columbia. I'm just saying, when people sit down and say, to the degree to which government has a hand in their pocket, besides every time they go and purchase something, and housing is one they talk about. We do, because they do. They're the ones saying, I care about affordable housing, which is why I'm critical.
Well, and you have a right to be. I mean, they did put in the budget some 600 plus million for services to tackle homelessness, including money for use at risk and rent subsidy increases and so on. And they also pledged to continue a 10-year housing plan to deliver 114,000 homes. Now, Jim Atkey, the chief executive of a nonprofit housing association, said, well, he welcomes an expansion of support for people experiencing homelessness, but he says the budget accelerated planning expenses as spending on only 850 of the 10,000 affordable homes lined up and awaiting funding.
And again, drop in the bucket. I'm not knocking it either. Drop in the bucket, though, when you look at the population increase that's being projected. I just think people have to be aware, and they have to say enough already at some point, to the degree to which government is taking so many different ways that they take money out of people's pocket. And this way we're talking about affordability. And as you say, it's a 10-year plan. Where is government going to get money? It worries me because they go after real estate. That's where the majority of us have the most of our income. You know, most of our net wealth is in real estate. Not a surprise, but man, this is just a reminder to the degree.
We should mention that first-time buyers are exempt. You know, there are some benefits. And very, very quickly, just should we have a big rumor coming up that for investors, the down payment is going to increase somewhere between 25% to 35%, and maybe your HELOC may not be able to be used for investment real estate. These are all rumors.
Yeah, we've got more. We'll have more time later, but I've still got to say, whenever you go after investors, your worry is they will not produce the supply you need. And there's no doubt we have a supply problem with the government planning over a three-year period starting this year, 1.1 million newcomers into the country. They got to live somewhere. So you do need more supply. That would seem obvious. So don't discourage it. Oh, we could go on all day, and I do. And I know that, Ozzy. I do. But you do a great job. So thanks very much for taking the time. And I'll remind people, go to ozbuzz.ca. The most Zeds in any address in Canada, ozbuzz.ca. Ozzy Jurek, thanks, Ozzy.
Thanks, Michael, and thank you so much. I'm thinking golf again, so I went the other day hitting some balls, and I was really proud. The pro said to me, look, keep your head down, keep your head down. And then I was very, as I said, very proud. And then the guy beside me said, look, the only reason he tells you to keep your head down is so you can't see him laughing.
Well, I experienced that laughter, and I really do have to take my lederhosen off after 1 week. So there you go, Ozzy. Thanks for taking the time. Victor Dare joins me live from the trading desk. And as I promised, I'm going to start with a little story. You know, Vic, last week, and I thought it was a great thing to introduce to many people, it was an introduction, that they want to know a reason why a market moves this way or that way. And you said, well, a lot of times the reason is the structure of what's going on in trading. For example, I may be playing a commodity to go down, or a stock, what have you, or I may be playing it to go up. I may have borrowed money to do that. And that plays a huge part when prices are extreme. Well, I thought of you on Monday when I watched the price of nickel, and people should sit down and listen to this, that we had the price of nickel move around 250% in 2 days. And then the London, the LME canceled trading. They said no more trading. They actually canceled trades. Vic, I got to wade in with that because that's exactly what you were warning us about.
Yeah, I called it something like, I want to be on the other side, or I want to front run the market when we're having price action go contrary to what the consensus is. So if everybody's sort of, everybody knows that such and such a market is going up and they've got long positions on, and then something happens and the market starts to go down, well, then like the first guy to get out sets off a little more pressure on the next guy, and we get into a falling dominoes kind of a thing. And I love those sort of markets. You know, they're certainly interesting. In my trading desk notes last week, I wrote that there's unintended consequences always in the market. And this is the sort of thing we're talking about. But particularly with soaring commodity prices, what I wrote was that somewhere there was a massive short position. I mean, the most obvious one was Europe was massively short energy, you know, because prices were going up and they were getting killed. Another thought was somewhere there's a massive short position in food, you know, and the government's going to get toppled, you know, when the people of the country start, you know, banging down the walls of the castle. But where it actually showed up here this week was in nickel. We had a let me turn it back to you, Mike.
Yeah, well, just to make sure everyone understands, people will make bets on the direction of the market. So if they're playing it to go down, they call that being short. If they're playing it to go up, it's called being long. But yeah, go ahead, because we had a Chinese billionaire who got featured, and their repercussions are huge. You know, some guy bets against a rising nickel price. Uh-oh, we're talking tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars lost.
Well, let's start with this. The whole true story is never going to come out. Okay, so we're going to talk about what we think we know and make some guesses. There was a Chinese businessman who was in the nickel business, apparently owned a very, very large mining company, a manufacturing company in nickel. And the trading that he had on being short the LME may have been what we would call a hedge. If you're a gold mining company, you might sell forward gold to guarantee you the income to pay your employees and so on, and to have a profit. Anyway, the guy's short, nickel goes screaming to the upside, and there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in margin calls being dished out everywhere. And this is where you start to see the panic in the market that somebody's going to fail to meet a call. So we got to that stage.
Yeah, so the margin is the loan that they require. They have to put up more money when the market goes against them. And this was just so much money. But Vic, the thing that I think when I read a lot of commodity traders, I mean, professionals like yourself, saying this is unprecedented. They canceled the trades, you know, of some people. They closed the trading. It still hasn't traded, you know, 5 days later.
Well, the LME, that's the London Metals Exchange, used to be a British concern. It is now owned by the Hong Kong Stock Exchange Group. They did that. They did cancel some of the trades. Now, you know, you can argue that the job of the exchange is to see that things go along relatively smoothly and, you know, none of the participants get hurt unduly. Whatever. Yes, they did take an unusual step. They canceled. They said, like, Monday never happened. Forget it, you know, just, and we'll settle on this other or part of Monday, whatever it was. And it seems that things have calmed down a little bit since then in terms of what might have happened. Now, also on Monday, like all of the metals that were trading on the LME just skyrocketed. Copper went to a new all-time high above $5 and subsequently fell back. The share price of the CME Group, that's the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is an amalgam of a number of derivatives exchanges around the world, it got hit pretty hard. I tell you what, coming into this week, even without hearing about the nickel guy, I was wondering if the brokerage firm that I use to execute my trades might be having some problems, and the money that I've got with that brokerage firm might disappear. That has happened in the past. So, you know, I was wondering if I had an existential risk that I hadn't even thought about last week because of this sort of thing. And I wasn't the only guy thinking that way. Obviously, it was rippling out all over the world.
I want to make sure that people know that this is something I'm saying. This is not what Victor's saying. But this is a bigger issue here also. As we're talking about the internal structures of these markets, I mean, what trades are on, what aren't, I've been highly critical of the casualness with which we took on debt as a country. that we had economists who should know better, or maybe they don't know better, say the debt's affordable. And I said, man, are you ever making a lot of assumptions about financial institutions, who owns what? For example, Vic, another one you just mentioned, of course, you know, potential losses in the commodity exchanges. How about people who own, or institutions, maybe banks, who own Russian bonds, now priced at zero, basically. Russian stocks, not allowed to trade them anyways if they're in Russia. So these are the financial situations that you have to be aware are possible. As you said, all of a sudden it became, you went, oh my gosh, maybe it's possible, nothing to do with me, but my money might not be safe. That's where you get systemic risks. And as I say, it happened to be nickel that popped up, going up to $1,000, for goodness sakes, you know, my head reels. And that produced a ripple effect. Well, the same thing can happen in the credit markets, you know, with the debt markets, and it's sitting right in front of us, staring at us.
Well, you know, somewhere somebody's got a big short position in the energy space. And, you know, we've had over the past 40 odd years that I've been trading in crude oil and that, we've seen blow ups. Somebody comes to the rescue. I'm going to call these iceberg risks. You know, the old, you see 10% of the iceberg, but 90% of it's underwater. There are these risks out there, and markets sense these risks. And the way that shows up is liquidity really thins out. Like, who wants to do a trade if you don't have to? So, you know, you back away. And also in the option volatility metrics. I mean, across a number of markets, like gold this week, when gold shot up to new all-time highs, I forget it, I think Monday or Tuesday, option volatility on gold traded to what I think was an all-time high. It was extraordinarily high. And I remember sitting with a silver mining magnate, a friend of you and me, he's been on the show before, in Geneva a number of years ago. And I was saying to him, you know something? When the silver market gets smoking to the upside, people just pay through the nose to buy out of the money calls, and you should be selling those calls to them.
Yeah, and that's what we're looking at. Mispricing, we're looking at, I mean, my message has been for quite a while, expand your imagination. The level of volatility should tell you that things are possible. Things that you told, not you, things that people would have told me, oh, that can't happen. That can you? I bet the Russians are sitting there going, I didn't know the ruble could get under 1 cent US. I didn't know our inflation rate, as I was talking to Mike Levy about earlier, could get to 100%. There are so many things like that. Certainly didn't know, you know, that nickel prices could go like that, as you said, or energy prices. That has got to inform our decision making. And yet I see very little evidence in political world, for example, that's appreciated.
Well, we could maybe wrap it up on this. You know, we've talked over the last 2 or 3 or 4 years about FOMO, the fear of missing out. You know, that's the markets going up and you're getting left behind. Well, I think in some degree that's been replaced by the fear of not being able to get out. Okay. And that's when the market's just surging against you and you can't get, I mean, this last little period of time here, we had the wheat market close limit up half a dozen times, that means it doesn't trade. If you were short wheat, you're getting killed and you can't do anything about it. You're going to get killed even more tomorrow is what I'm saying.
That's the environment we're trading in. Well, thanks, Vic. I'll invite people to go to Victor Adair, victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. And I'll tell you this, Vic, wait till you hear this week's Goofy. I am dipping into the Hall of Fame and it is so deserved, but it's a jaw dropper. That's coming up next.
Good for you.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. And hey, with apologies for dipping into the Goofy Hall of Fame, but I could not help myself after reading Prime Minister Trudeau's remarks this week in Berlin. I mean, hey, I am flabbergasted by the lack of self-awareness, and it's enough to win this week's Goofy. But I do want to acknowledge those people whose political allegiance is above all else, who will not be happy with any criticism of Mr. Trudeau. Let me just say, I do get it. I'm a low life or worse for doing it. I agree. But let's get on with the reason for the award. And my thanks, by the way, to the National Post, Chris Selly, for bringing the remarks to my attention. In Berlin, the Prime Minister stated in quotes, "The infinite dignity of each individual means no one should be left out of society." This is also true for people who hold different political views. We all need to commit to more listening and less shouting. Diversity of ideas helps us learn from one another. Talking with people who think differently from us is how we challenge ourselves, and challenging ourselves is how we grow. End of quote. I mean, really, is he freaking kidding? We all need to commit to more listening. This is from the leader who outright dismissed the truckers' convoy immediately as it got started with unfounded allegations of racism, misogyny, and white supremacy. Echoed by many in the mainstream media, and there wasn't one iota of evidence. In quotes, talking with people who think differently from us is how we challenge ourselves, and challenging ourselves is how we grow, end of quote. Well, which is immediately on the short list for the most delusional, dishonest statements by a Canadian prime minister in generations. Come on, he is not talking about challenging the climate change agenda. He's not talking about challenging the government's COVID response or any aspect of the progressive left's agenda. And what's just as troubling is that so many in the mainstream media who report on the government, along with the educational establishment, agree with him. No questions. Come on, the no questions allowed attitude is the dominant characteristic of our public debate. There are so many no-fly zones on every tenet of the progressive agenda. Now, I do agree with the Prime Minister when he says challenging ourselves by talking with people who think differently is how we grow. But the evidence is that approach has been overwhelmingly dismissed out of hand. What I will leave to professionals to discern, really, how could he have actually made that statement just weeks after the truckers' convoy? I mean, it's just so blatantly out of touch with reality and what's been going on in public debate in this country for 5 years, 6 years. That's all the time we have, but I got to finish with this one more time. I got to sincerely thank everyone who helped and donated to Special Olympics. No group is more deserving, more group, and I can give you the stats, and I will. You got to trust me. You know me. I go on and on, but I will. No group was more ignored by public health authorities than people with intellectual disabilities, despite the fact that other than old age, it was the number one variable for COVID deaths. Why? Because most people with intellectual disabilities suffer from comorbidities. The point being, though, you did not ignore them. Over 500 of our audience listening and following us on mikesmoneytalks.ca or Money Talks tweets, following us on Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook, they donated. I just can't thank you enough. And I know talking directly with family members of people with intellectual disabilities, it is so heartwarming to see that there are people who care in our communities like this. And it won't be the last time I talk about this. This is a big deal to me, and it was a big deal the way you responded. I hope you go out and have an absolutely terrific week. We're talking about the biggest issues in finance. Please tell your friends to tune in. A more educated public is in all our best interests. Thank you.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.